Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
4 men, 2 by 2, had gone into the howling maelstrom that was Jupiter and had not returned. They had walked into the keening gale, or rather, they had loped, bellies low against the ground, wet sides gleaming in the rain, for they did not go in the shape of men. Now the 5th man stood before the desk of Kent Fowler, head of Dome Number 3, Jovian Survey Commission. Under Fowler's desk, old Towser scratched a flea, then settled down to sleep again. Harold Allen, Fowler saw with a sudden pang, was young, too young. He had the easy confidence of youth, the face of one who had never had known fear, and that was strange. For men in the domes of Jupiter did know fear. Fear and humility.
Ooh, 4 men have gone to Jupiter and are now missing? And they were not in the shape of men? What does that mean? Folks, it looks like we got us here a sci-fi mystery.
It really is a mystery because we've had the slight tonal change in the show. On HP Podcraft, there would be no mystery. It would just be, yeah, those dudes got devoured by monsters.
Yeah.
Here, I wasn't 100% sure where it would all end up. So that was great.
I loved it. This is the short sci-fi story, Desertion, by Clifford Samak, and we are going to unravel this mystery with a strange study of a strange story. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. This story was recommended by listener Daniel Mills, who wrote us to say it's a classic science fiction story in which humans take on alien bodies to explore the gaseous surface of Jupiter. A strange and strangely beautiful story with an ending I often think about. So Daniel himself leaves a little mystery there. Is the ending that he's thinking about all the time terrifying him when he thinks about it? The fact that he does say it's a beautiful story, it tips it a little towards the positive, but I still wasn't sure.
Uh-huh.
I have to say that after reading it, I agree with his assessment that the story is beautiful. It really did move me, having just read it a couple hours ago. And so did that reading I just heard. Whose was that handsome voice?
That is none other than Graham Eberhart. Graham is 50% of the duo known as Mayhem Lettuce. Mayhem Lettuce released their 6th album, Complete Sentences, in May. All of the song titles are, get this, Complete Sentences. See what they did there?
Yeah.
You could find it by searching for Mayhem Lettuce on Bandcamp, Spotify, Amazon, etc., all those places. They are also working on a Lovecraft-themed project, which will likely come out next year.
Isn't it about time you had a salad? Isn't it about time you embraced the chaos? Mayhem Lettuce. Graham read for us, by the way, way back in our inaugural year of 2009 on The Quest of Uranon.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right.
Which I only remember as a story about some kid who couldn't get a job or wouldn't get a job. I think his mom was mad at him. Something like that.
We covered Clifford Samak before, back on episode 408 of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, with the story The Street That Wasn't There, which he co-wrote with Carl Jacoby.
That was a really mind-bending story about the nature of reality. This one, Desertion, kind of surprised me because I thought, wait, is this the source material for Avatar? You know, I've heard James Cameron talk about the influence of John Carter of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs as source material. In fact, I think he said all of the science fiction he read when he was a kid was inspiration for that movie, as well as obviously Dances with Wolves, Princess Mononoke. It's like a lot of things.
Sure.
And that's obvious, but just on a cursory search, I couldn't find any mention of this story in the background of him creating those films. Maybe it's been acknowledged. I don't know. Let's talk about it a little at the end of the show after we've done a synopsis.
Just a bio recap here, because we talked about him before. Clifford Samak was born in 1904 in Millville, Wisconsin.
I'm still getting used to this. Hey, I live in Wisconsin.
You do.
He attended the university here in Madison as well.
He was mostly a journalist, but he wrote for lots of pulp and sci-fi magazines. He won the Science Fiction Writers of America Award as the 3rd Grandmaster, which was in 1977.
Only to be quickly replaced by Grandmaster Flash in 1979. Does that still play? Do people know who I'm talking about?
White Lines.
There you go. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious 5. White Lines, awesome song. The Message is another one that people might know. Father of Hip Hop, folks, check it out. Doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about. Back to Grandmaster Clifford.
In 1987, he got the Bram Stoker Award for Lifetime Achievement, and he has an asteroid named after him. I gotta say, I was a little surprised to find out that his real name is 228883 Cliff Smack.
Well, you're not just a number to us, Cliff, despite that being your real name. He passed away in 1988, not long after that award. Hopefully he's out there riding that asteroid around. You know, it's as likely as anything else.
Is it?
Yeah! I imagine it's happening.
This... This story, Desertion, was first published in the November 1944 issue of Astounding Science Fiction.
He's one of the Golden Age writers, just as we are Golden Age podcasters, I've decided. Let's talk about this. Let's get into the story.
Alrighty. It begins with this guy, Fowler, who's in charge of a space operation out near Jupiter. They are doing something a bit different than what we see typically in sci-fi stories and movies and things. They aren't terraforming planets, but they're changing humans so that they can live in alien environments.
Which seems, if you have the ability to do that, a better way to go. This became an idea in science fiction stories that it's called pantropy, first coined by science fiction author James Blish, who wrote a series of short stories based on the idea that are collected in his 50s anthology, The Seedling Stars. This story, though, is a pretty early example. In fact, the only prior example that I could find just on some quick research is from 1930 in the science fiction novel Last and First Men by Olaf Stapledon. Humanity migrates from Earth to Venus, later from Venus to Neptune, and human beings are genetically engineered to fit the new environments in which they'll be living. Mm-hmm. And then you have this in 44. About 10 years later, there's Blish's anthology of stories. The one that is best known from that anthology is called Surface Tension. It's from 1952, and it's anthologized a lot. And then they pop up every decade after that, a short story or two about this pantropy idea. You can check on the Wikipedia entry for pantropy to see those examples. In this story, we've got Fowler living in a dome, dome number three. He's got a dog named Towser, clearly some kind of awful responsibility that he has, sending men who've been changed into some kind of beings off into these harsh environs not to return.
Now, they have two sets of two that are down on Jupiter, but they have disappeared. I know this is science fiction, but this landing on Jupiter thing wouldn't really work quite as Samak writes. I went to the NASA website and I got a little information just for some reality, a little dose of reality.
Yeah.
As a gas giant, Jupiter doesn't have a true surface. The planet is mostly swirling gases and liquids. While a spacecraft would have nowhere to land on Jupiter, it wouldn't be able to fly through unscathed either. The extreme pressures and temperatures deep inside the planet crush, melt, and vaporize spacecraft trying to fly into the planet. Jupiter's appearance is a tapestry of colorful cloud bands and spots. The gas planet likely has three distinct cloud layers in its skies, that's in quotes, that taken together span about 44 miles, 71 kilometers. The top cloud is probably made up of ammonia ice, while the middle layer is likely made up of ammonium hydrosulfide crystals. The innermost layer may be made of water, ice, and vapor. That tells me that the whole character of Charlie 27 is bullpoop.
Man, I'm a bad Marvel fan because I saw Charlie 27 in your notes, didn't know what you were talking about, so I had to look it up. That's a Marvel character, a Guardians of the Galaxy character, who's from Jupiter.
Yes.
So that's why you're saying that. It looks like Ving Rhames plays him in the movies.
I didn't realize that's who he was supposed to be. He was just in there in Guardians of the Galaxy 2 when they had all the Reavers. They had some of the old school Guardians, because Guardians came out in the 70s. They're totally different characters.
Yeah.
And then the newer Guardians of the Galaxy, when, you know, I think in the 2000s, you got Star-Lord and all those
things. The ones that we know in the movies are the newer team. And so that's when they show, it was Stallone's team in part two, where they just showed up for a second. It was like Michelle Yeoh and Ving Rhames and Stallone. It was like, wait a minute, what? I hope that those characters come back, because that was pretty exciting little reveal they did there.
Yeah.
Also exciting is all of the cool hip hop names that could come out of that description of Jupiter you read. Gas Giant would be a good one. Ammonia Ice. I'm going to take that one for myself. The way you're describing Jupiter, that could just be your limited perception of the situation as a human.
True.
You know, to us, it's just ammonia gas, but to a loper, that's a field of miracles.
Anyway, we're going to accept this is a story and just roll with it. Fowler has lost four guys altogether in these expeditions, and now they're going to send down another, Harold Allen.
And as you heard, it's tragic right off the bat. This is a young guy, too young, Fowler thinks. Easy confidence of youth, and a face that has never known fear.
Fowler stresses that this is a voluntary mission, but Allen is going to do his duty and help his fellow surveyors?
His fellow red shirts?
They're not part of a military organization or anything like that, so it doesn't quite work, but whatever.
Yeah.
Fowler makes things clear.
You understand, said Fowler, that you need not do this. You understand you need not go. It was formula, of course. The other four had been told the same thing, but they'd gone. This fifth one, Fowler knew, would go as well. But suddenly, he felt a dull hope stir within him that Allen wouldn't go. When do I start? Asked Allen. What a typical red shirt. There had been a time when Fowler might have taken quiet pride in that answer, but not now. He frowned briefly. Within the hour, he said. Allen stood waiting, quietly. That'd be a tough thing to be eager about, getting turned into another creature and running off into the unknown, but this guy, I guess, wants to impress his superiors.
I guess, but it sounds kind of cool, too.
Yeah.
In a way, I mean, I don't know if I would do it, but if I was in my 20s, I bet you I probably would.
Oh, yeah, I had, you know, acne, a lot of acne back then, too, so I would have been more than happy to exchange bodies with another creature. Get rid of this oily shell.
Fowler says, 4 other men have gone out and have not returned. You know that, of course. We want you to return. We don't want you going off on any heroic rescue expedition. The main thing is, the only thing is that you come back, that you prove man can live in a Jovian form. Go to the first survey stake, no further, then come back. Don't take any chances. Don't investigate anything. Just come back.
I got a little sense of annihilation from this a bit. I've only seen the film. But that sense of horror in that setup. Yeah, we've sent a bunch of soldiers off into that dome and they haven't come back. So you're up, which was sort of the premise in that film. In fact, the author of the book Annihilation, I have it and it's 2 sequels over here in the library I'm going to read soon. But Jeff Vandermeer, he included this story, Desertion, in the Big Book of Science Fiction, which I'm coveting currently. Uh-huh. It's edited by he and Anne Vandermeer. I really want to get that one. Those guys are like rock stars to me now, rock star editors. It seems like everything that is, you know, comes out of one of their anthologies I love.
Yeah.
But this, you've got to prove man can live in a Jovian form, of course, also made me think of Avatar. That's where it started happening.
So Fowler explains that Miss Stanley will be running the converter. Stanley seems to be either angry or sad about this whole thing, but she's trying to hide it. It seems that the converter is not actually the problem. They get to where they're going intact, but they lose them soon afterwards. They convert into this new form. They're around for a bit, and then they're just gone.
Yeah.
This whole expedition is important for colonizing Jupiter. It's full of resources that humans could use.
Some unobtainable resources, doubtless.
As you mentioned, Fowler has a dog, Towser, who is there with him in his office under his desk.
Yeah, Towser's included enough in the story that he's clearly not just there to characterize our central character, although it does do something towards characterizing him in that, you know, it's almost a shorthand that he's a good guy. He's somebody sending people off to a possibly awful fate, so it might be easy to interpret him as a villain or corporate stooge or even just like a hawkish military-industrial complex person. The writing in this story is brisk, as seems to be the case with most of the 40s, 50s sci-fi we've been looking at so far. The style is get the facts out and just the facts, kind of. So this dog is a quick tip that he's somebody who cares about other things. Mm. I'm reminded a little bit, isn't that Star Trek show with Captain Bacula? He has a dog in that one, right?
He does.
Yeah, and that's it kind of right away, it makes you feel sort of soft towards him.
Alan is excused and he goes to prepare for the mission. Miss Stanley sticks around and gives Fowler a bit of a reaming. How many guys are you going to keep sending down there? How many young men have to die? Fowler coldly says that if a few men die for progress, so be it. That's the way all civilizations move forward.
She bothers him, even though he's angry at her resistance at first. It seems like this feeling of discomfort's been going on for some time. With each passing red shirt, she's gotten a little more upset because she's the one that's doing the conversions. She's changing them into these lopers. It says he wasn't exactly afraid of her, but he didn't feel quite comfortable when she was around. These sharp blue eyes saw too much. Her hands looked far too competent. She should be somebody's aunt sitting in a rocking chair with her knitting needles, but she wasn't. She was the top-notch conversion unit operator in the solar system, and she didn't like the way he was doing things. So he has doubt, and this person he really respects is reinforcing that.
Yeah.
I recently rewatched The Guns of Navarone, which is, I don't know if I would say that's a great movie, but it's a favorite of mine from childhood. I used to watch it with my dad, and I really noticed that there's this character whose job it is to send men off to missions that will probably kill them. You know, he's like a military lower official. And it's not important to the plot. In fact, it even slows the movie down a bit. But that movie takes the time to show a scene with him and his assistant where he just rues that he's got to ruin a generation of men from the comfort of his office. I don't know, it hit me in a different way. I never even noticed it when I was young. Hmm. And Fowler is in that position. It felt very much like that. It's his job to send people off what he presumes to their death, and it weighs pretty heavy on him. So this disapproval, you get the sense that that's just the job that's been assigned to him. He didn't choose to do this.
Yeah.
And her disapproval makes it all the worse.
There seems to be life already on Jupiter, and the highest form of life they call a loper. They are made for Jupiter's gravity and pressure. Their bodies are structured in a way that they can survive there. If they would go to Earth, they would just dissipate into a puff of gas because they couldn't survive in that low pressure environment.
Right. They've evolved for Jupiter and we've evolved for Earth, which is also an important idea in the story. And I think just an important idea in general to think, you know, we're not really the key organisms. The planet is. Mm-hmm. And we're parasites on the organism. I mean, we are evolved to exist just here mm-hmm. and here only. We've adapted over tens of thousands of years to this environment, and any kind of space travel really messes us up. Mm. And that's why they send astronauts to the space station to live for a year, because they say it on the surface, we want to see how messed up they are when they come back. What happened to you, Kelly? You know, your yeah. bones don't work anymore? Take some notes on that, you know? Yeah. So that's it's a nice thing that those guys are doing.
Nice.
It is. I mean, there's no doubt yeah. that it's going to lower their life expectancy.
It messes them up, yeah. Alan goes on the mission. Alan does not come back from the mission. Hmm. The tractors go out to look for him, but they only catch a sight of a distant loper.
And then we have a final scene where Fowler looks off in the distance and says, I guess the saber-toothed Dracula's got to another one. The end.
The end. That was a great story.
Yeah, wow. No. Did not go the way I thought.
Fowler consults the biologist. Maybe there's something wrong with the conversion process. Maybe they aren't transformed quite right. And the biologists say, well, it's going to take us years to figure out if there is something wrong, if that's the case.
Yeah, because of this harsh environment, things that would take quite a short amount of time on Earth are obviously taking them very, very long period of time. And these biologists are annoyed that he's even asking about it because they spent years getting everything right here. But I wonder, it says conversion process. So is it a werewolf kind of transformation? Or are they just pulling their brains out and putting them in new bodies? Or is it an AI thing?
They don't explain it at all. They don't go into the technology, which I kind of appreciate because it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, it's a smart thing to leave out because you don't know what an audience down the road is going to know about this stuff. Also, you know, sometimes when they're setting these things on Jupiter or planets within the solar system, it seems a little short-sighted. Maybe we didn't know all that stuff at the time, but it seemed like within our grasp, those planets are close enough to study. But these things are like silicone and ammonia or something, so it's got to be a conscience transference of some kind instead of an actual physical conversion. But who knows? Calling them lopers just makes me think they look like space werewolves. So I did think maybe it was a transformation. By the way, space werewolves, that's all right with me.
More of that, please. Fowler also wonders which lopers are real lopers and which ones are the transformed men. Hmm. Maybe turning into something other than a man, the man would not be able to maintain his human intelligence, that somehow there's mental breakdown because it's a completely different structure, chemical and otherwise.
Right. And we, of course, being humans, think of it as a breakdown, like you said. It'd be a terrible thing. You'd lose what, you know, your mind, which we have these highly developed minds, and suddenly not being able to understand anything because of the physical change. One imagines it's like a de-evolution into this beast-like intelligence that perhaps happens. But it's a key perception here. It's not overplayed in the story, which is great because I was just tracking with Fowler. Oh yeah, maybe they turn into dumb animals.
Yeah. Just as he's thinking, Towser the dog comes back into the room with a bone from the kitchen.
That was another thing Fowler was worried about with sending these guys off. They really only have a few domes on this planet, and most of what's going on out there, you know, they don't know anything about at all. So, you know, the dog with the bone, maybe this is happening out there where something is gobbling up these lopers as soon as they're out. Mm. A giant super loper of some kind, an interloper. I was thinking, yes. I'd like to see whatever this monster is.
So Fowler looks at the files of potential men for the next mission. Bennett. Nah, he's got a girl back home. Andrews, he's going back to university. Olson, almost ready to retire. Fowler's conscience is getting to him. He can't send these men. Then he gets an idea. Fowler calls in Miss Stanley and tells her to prepare for two this time, not one. But one of the two is going to be a dog. Towser.
And she's pissed about that. Your own dog? He's been with you for years and you're going to send him off to die like this?
Ah, but the other person? Himself.
Awesome. I should have seen it coming, but I was just like Miss Stanley. I was mad at him about the dog.
Yeah.
And then, by the way, in my head, Miss Stanley is Louise Fletcher, the actress who played Nurse Ratched. I don't know why. It's really not important to our discussion here, but I did cast that part.
You had Louise Fletcher. I saw Grace Jones.
Yeah. Oh, did you really?
Yeah. Huh. We cut to the man and his dog now in loper bodies on the surface of Jupiter. He's perceiving this environment in a new way. Before, it looked like a hellish storm, but now it's pleasant and it's beautiful.
Ah.
Fowler absorbs odors in his new form, smelling, but not really smelling. Something like lavender, but not really lavender.
Mm.
His earth thoughts aren't quite compatible with his new Loper form or his mind.
I was so pleased by this turn of events because right at this moment, you realize, oh, this is going to be a good thing. The other guys didn't come back, but not because they were gobbled up by Jupiter bears. They didn't come back because being a Loper is just the best.
Yeah. So he notices Towser next to him and he senses it's his dog, but it's different. Can Fowler talk as a Loper? And then he senses words from Towser. And he says, hiya, pal. But they aren't really words. They're almost symbols.
They have this incredibly connected, telepathic style of communication that's difficult to even describe to a human. It's so profound and different.
And Towser expresses that he feels great, that he's been getting old as a dog and sore, but now he feels like a pup again. And Fowler is a little freaked out his dog can talk to him. But Towser said, man, I've always talked to you. You just didn't always understand me.
This is so appealing that you and your pet could go get in different bodies and be young again and go run off on some cool planet. It's like, I knew this was possible.
Fowler apologizes. He seems really sad that he wasn't getting that this dog was trying to communicate all these things to him.
Mm.
But Towser's like, hey, don't sweat it. It's no big deal, man. We're here now. Race you to the cliff. And he runs off. Now, the cliff is far, but what else are they doing, he thinks. And then I thought, dude, your mission. What?
Yeah.
Do your mission. Fowler decides to try out his new body.
As he ran, the consciousness of music came to him, a music that beat into his body, that surged throughout his being, that lifted him on wings of silver speed, music like bells might make from some steeple on a sunny springtime hill. That's how I felt first time I heard Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, exactly the same way.
When he gets there, he sees an ammonia waterfall and cliffs made of solid oxygen. Towser says, the music. Fowler says, oh, you can hear it? And Towser says, oh yeah, I can feel the vibrations. And Fowler goes, how do you know about vibrations? You're a dog. And the dog says, well, it just popped into my head. Then suddenly Fowler gets an idea for a formula to make metal that would be strong enough to exist on Jupiter. Just like that. It's some problem that humanity has had and not been able to solve, and he's just some dude and he's figured it out just like in a second. So he shouts at the dog, something is happening to us, and the dog says, I know.
It's our brains, said Fowler. We're using them, all of them, down to the last hidden corner, using them to figure out things we should have known all the time. Maybe the brains of Earth things naturally are slow and foggy. Maybe we're the morons of the universe. Maybe we're fixed so we have to do things the hard way. He sensed other things not quite clear, a vague whispering that hinted of greater things, of mysteries beyond the pale of human thought, beyond even the pale of human imagination. Mysteries, fact, logic built on reasoning, things that any brain should know if it used all its reasoning power.
Couple of things about that. Well, you made reference to him just, you know, thinking up the formula for this metal that would be strong enough to exist on Jupiter. That's so neat.
Mm-hmm.
But it was horrifying earlier in the story when you described there's not many of these domes, and the ones that they have, if the electricity cuts out or something, they're just dead.
Yeah.
You know, they'll get crushed. They're really reliant on their generators because they have to have a field strong enough to resist the enormous amount. It just dwarfs undersea pressure that's on this planet.
Yeah.
And that conceptually was so cool. As global warming continues and things heat up or get colder, we're also relying on these technologies. I mean, obviously, so much of the world is colonized because of air conditioning that people wouldn't have lived in before.
Oh, yeah.
But it gets more extreme year over year. So that was a neat connection. And then there's also this 10% of the brain thing, right? Which was such a popular idea at the time.
And Fowler, he thinks human bodies are just kind of crap. They don't work very well. They can't perceive as much as these new bodies. And the brains work only about at 10% efficiency. And I could be wrong, but I think that whole thing was some bad science that was done where they were taking up part of people's brains or people had injuries.
Yeah. We've talked about it before, how it's become a trope, or not a trope, but it's become like a saying, you know, oh, humans only use 10% of their brains, as if there's 90% if we had access to all of this stuff would open up to us. And it's just not true. But that was a really popular idea at the time, especially with the editor of this magazine the story was in, Campbell.
So he thought that the whole experience of changing bodies and going to Jupiter was going to be a difficult adjustment, but it's not. It's amazing and it's liberating. So Towser says he wants to explore. Both he and Fowler have a sense that there is more out there, a higher destiny of some kind. And that knowledge and adventure are just past the horizon. They can, if they if they just explore a little bit more, they're going to open up this whole new vista. And he knows that the others must have felt this too, and that's why they didn't return. So Towser says he's not going back, but Fowler doesn't want to let them down, you know, the people that they sent, because they're very confused about what's happened to these guys.
Yeah.
So he's going to actually stick to his mission. I was like, all right, he's going to do it. So he begins to step back, but then he doesn't want to go back either.
Back to the dome. Back to that aching, poison-laden body he had left. It hadn't seemed aching before, but now he knew it was. Back to the fuzzy brain. Back to muddled thinking. Back to the flapping mouths that formed signals others understood. Back to eyes that now would be worse than no sight at all. Back to squalor. Back to crawling. Back to ignorance. Perhaps someday, he said, muttering to himself.
We got a lot to do and a lot to see, said Towser. We got a lot to learn. We'll find things.
Yes, they could find things. Civilizations, perhaps. Civilizations that would make the civilization of man seem puny by comparison. Beauty and, more important, an understanding of that beauty, and a comradeship no one had ever known before, that no man, no dog had ever known before. And life. The quickness of life after what seemed a drugged existence.
I can't go back, said Towser.
Nor I, said Fowler.
They would turn me back into a dog, said Towser.
And me, said Fowler, back into a man.
That's the end of the story. That's cool.
That is a beautiful ending and so cool. Obviously, you'd think, yeah, the dog doesn't want to be a dog again, but this guy, I don't want to be a man either. It was gross.
I think that's perfect. It's using that dog analogy, which I've used lots in transhumanism about intelligences advancing. We do things that dogs could never understand. No matter how much time you spend with a dog, it'll never get going on a computer and ordering something online. It's beyond its comprehension.
Yeah.
The idea of me becoming a dog is pretty horrific because I'm like, oh my God, I would lose all of this parts of myself. In the story, they're like, well, I'm going to be turned back into a man. So they're at this higher elevated level, and it's a good, you know, analogy for us to be able to understand, oh, so that's what it's like for these guys, these loper people. They don't want to go back to being something, even though it was who they were. It's not who they are anymore.
It's so great because that works on the level that you're talking about, which is a little abstract, that we'd be so far past being humans that we'd be sort of disgusted that we were humans. But it works on a real primal level because what person hasn't left a situation, looked back and gone, God, I can't believe I lived like that. Or I saw the world that way. Mm-hmm. When I was in it, I didn't see it. And now that I'm out of it, I see it. And I think it were, everybody can understand what this means. And yeah, you've been in a situation where you're like, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to that.
No.
Now, there is a sequel to this story I discovered. Okay. I didn't have time to read it, but on the Classics of Science Fiction blog, luckily, a fellow named James Wallace Harris summarized it. So I'm going to read that to you. It says, 5 years later, Fowler does return to the dome in the story Paradise. He feels it's essential that he let his fellow humans know about this greater stage of consciousness. In this story, though, we also learn that humanity is facing another crisis point in their development. Superior humans called mutants also exist, as do uplifted dogs and intelligent robots.
Oh, nice.
When Fowler tries to spread the word that paradise can be found on Jupiter, his message is suppressed by Tyler Webster, who wants humans to stay human. Webster pleads with Fowler to withhold knowledge of the heaven on Jupiter because he fears all humans will rush to attain instant resurrection, in the words of the author.
Whoa.
Of this author. And here's a quote from the story, but I want you to think this over. A million years ago, man first came into being, just an animal. Since that time, he had inched his way up a cultural ladder. Bit by painful bit, he has developed a way of life, a philosophy, a way of doing things. His progress has been geometrical. Today, he does much more than he did yesterday. Tomorrow, he'll do even more than he did today. For the first time in human history, man is really beginning to hit the ball. He's got a good start, the first stride, you might say. He's going a lot farther in a lot less time than he's come already. Maybe it isn't as pleasant as Jupiter, maybe not the same at all. Maybe humankind is drab compared to the life forms of Jupiter, but it's man's life. It's the thing he's fought for. It's the thing he's made himself. It's a destiny he has shaped. I hate to think, Fowler, that just when we're going good, we'll swap our destiny for one we don't know about, for one we can't be sure about. I'll wait, said Fowler, just a day or two. But I'm warning you, you can't put me off. You can't change my mind. That's all I ask, said Webster. He rose and held out his hand. Shake on it? So some accord is reached, but you can see the perspective of both.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, transferring yourself to an alien body that you didn't earn, could definitely have all sorts of unforeseen consequences, correct? I mean,
yeah, possibly. Or it could be the next step in human evolution.
Yeah. It's,
you know, and with that transhumanism idea, not just with computers or artificial intelligences, it could just be a biological transformation. If humans are able to come up with the science to be able to alter our bodies to make them better, then that's part of the natural evolution of humans. Even though we're doing
right,
it,
yeah,
we're part of nature. So it still is how things happen. You know, maybe it's on a cellular level or a genetic level, which is more than we've ever done before. But if you look at history, humans have been changing their environment, have been building tools. And this is just another tool, a very complex tool. The tools of the past have also had consequences, obviously.
Absolutely. And also have been based on discovery of materials and discovery of other life forms and what they're doing. And so, you know, it's not necessarily just assuming another identity or assuming another culture. That's what we're always doing. You find minerals in rocks and then you eventually make an iPhone. So this is all, it's all discovery and evolution and complicated stuff and really exciting. This is a cool story. And it was related thematically to Mimsy Where the Borough Goes in terms of that ascendance of humanity, as well as Arena in terms of life forms functioning in different ways, different environments evolving them in different ways.
Yeah.
I can't say it's related much to the drunks having their hearts eaten out story as much.
This makes me really excited about our new show. You know, these stories, because this is something we never would have covered, I don't think, on HP Podcraft. And we're stretching out into these cool worlds of sci-fi because this is kind of a happy story in a way.
Well, it entertains the possibility in this sort of man versus the cosmos. It's not cosmic horror, but cosmic wonder. And we didn't get a lot of that. That's right. There was an inherent fear of things that we don't understand or that if you did uncover those vistas, they would make you feel so small that, you know, you'd want to retreat versus this, which says, gosh, I want to embrace it. I want to be a loper. I want to run away. And there was a little of that. If you think about the, you know, the brain cases in Whisperer in Darkness, aren't they saying, you have no idea what's out there. This is super cool.
Yeah. But also felt like a trick too.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. But those brain cases were a form of, they were something like this, I guess, a transfer of consciousness to another physical medium. And our author, Cliff Simak, was, I don't know, I mean, he was a contemporary of Lovecraft and writing around the same time. And in fact, I do think he has a story called, The Call from Beyond, which does owe quite a bit to the Cthulhu mythos and is similar to that kind of thing. So I think Clifford did write in that vein as well.
Maybe that's something we should check out. I really enjoyed the story, so I'd want to dig into Cliff a bit more.
Oh, absolutely, man. And I'm just like you. This got me really excited about the show. This whole month, you know, I love reading the science fiction. I love thinking about these things. And yeah, it's exciting stuff. Well, I want to thank Graham Eberhart for being our reader this week. It's been 12 years since we've had him, 13 years since we've had him on, and that is far too long a time. So hopefully he can come back. And when Pitch Black Manor reunited a couple of years ago, it was another awesome local band. Mayhem Lettuce was doing the same thing. So it felt like a little Quad Cities resurrection of the music scene that is much appreciated. And I've been loved listening to what they're doing. They actually did a remix for us as well at one point. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're old buds and I just love him and I'm glad that he's come on the show.
Yeah. And don't forget about their sixth album, Complete Sentences. Came out in May. You can get it anywhere that you get great music. And keep an eye out for their Lovecraft-themed project, which will be out next year.
I'm sure it's going to be good and kooky. I want to thank some patrons as well, speaking of good and kooky. I'm going to start by thanking Amir.
I'd like to thank Taxi Crab.
I'd like to thank Tom Foster.
Ian Bishop, thank you.
Josh Maxwell, thank you.
Thanks, Abe Warpinski.
Now, Abe Warpinski sounds like a science fiction name if I've ever heard.
Yeah, it does.
Warpinski. Omerkin Kirit, thank you.
Heath Anderson, thank you very much.
Frederick Bridell, thank you.
And Matt Bessel, thank you.
We're going to be back next with a bonus extra credit episode on Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. And then next month, I think we're going to do some Tolkien. Is that
right? Yes, we're going to kick off the month with a short story that J.R.R. Tolkien did called Leaf by Niggle, which is supposed to be a very good short story. So we'll check it out. And then next month, we're going to do some other stuff. We're going to go back to some Manly Wade and we're going to kick a little Asimov in the butt too.
Oh yeah, Bicentennial Man, right? We're going to finally do that one. Yep. Oh, it's going to be another great month next month. So please stick with us, folks. Thank you to our patrons for keeping the show going. And until next time, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.